For our show. Happy birthday to Jamie Hill. Special thanks today to Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Guzder, and special thanks to Denver Open Media, Tony Shawcross, and Ann Tice, and all the folks here that made this broadcast possible. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. Stay tuned for Positively Revolting Talk Radio right after this.
It'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot fail.
This is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KBOO a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm/food. We are proud to be your radio station and honored to have your support this fall membership drive. Thank you.
There's a new tech boom happening in Portland. This spring, Airbnb decided to relocate its North American headquarters in Portland. eBay also recently doubled its office space downtown. This means new jobs. This means more people moving to Portland. It also means rising rents. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Startup City, the first in a five-part series on how the new tech boom is changing Portland.
Wide open, the door is wide open, yeah. Good morning. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, your very own community radio station. First of all, we would love to thank all of the members who contributed. We had a kick blank
I think you membership. You can say but.
Okay, kick membership drive. We ended early. It was great. Thank you all so much. And let's keep that momentum going.
That was, I have to say, really fabulous. And mm-hmm. we do thank you very, very much for your generous support of your community radio station and, in fact, for being good members of the community.
Yes, and that was Chris Delmhorst, who is one of the few country and westerns people have put Rumi to words, but that was Everything is Music, and it's one of my favorite songs, and it sort of works this morning. I want to welcome our guests this morning because we are really pleased to be able to talk once again with Michael Mead. Michael is an author, storyteller, mythologist, and I say brilliant reconstructor of much-needed cultural ceremony and ritual. I will say that. His books include Why the World Doesn't End, Fate and Destiny, The Water of Life. He's got audio work, The Soul of Change, Fate and Destiny. If you want to see everything, because it will take too long to put it all to say it all this morning, go to mosaicvoices.org. On October 25th, Michael and Coleman Barks and Pia, am I saying that right, Michael?
Pia,
thank you. Well, that should have been really easy. We'll be presenting Soul Fury, an evening of ecstatic poetry for passionate friends and fearless lovers. We're going to be talking about that and other interesting topics this morning. I'm real interested in crushing the fog too, Michael. So, but good morning. Welcome back to KBOO.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, always a pleasure. So you want to, can you like enlighten our listeners about what this event is going to be that you're going to be doing with Coleman Barks?
Well, it's an ecstatic evening. It's an evening in search of the ecstatic. It's an evening born of the ecstatic. Coleman and I are old friends. I think we met over 30 years ago. And, of course, he's become world-renowned for translating the poetry of Rumi into, you know, an amazing form of English and bringing this ecstatic imagination, you know, into published form in the Western world. And so we're going to follow that ecstatic inspiration. Excuse me. Ecstatic means partly to be beside oneself, to be standing in a state other than the usual state that one wakes up in. And so we're going to be going after those altered states, which are sometimes the only refuge when all of the national states are deepening the confusion and pain of the world. Ecstasy is not like an escape. It's really an antidote to some of the pain of being alive. And then Pia is this young woman with an amazing voice that just carries words into song and carries songs into prayer. And so we're going to try to blend our voices and create an altered state as antidote to the darkness in the world.
Well, thanks very much for that. So, you know, I've been reading Soul Fury, and It's a lot about the friendship between Shams and Rumi. They're sort of an archetype for close friendship, don't you think? Because, you know, it seems like Rumi's the guy who's you know, level-headed and forgiving, and Shams is the coyote that just gets in there and stirs things up.
Yes, yeah, well said, yeah. Yeah, it's the conversation of the soul. And the soul, of course, has this great capacity for compassion. But inside the word compassion is the word passion. And so the soul has this unending capacity for the passion of being alive. And so, you know, Coleman has worked so carefully and so beautifully with this wild conversation. And in order not to have, I would think anyway, not to have Rumi be reduced to a simple thing, which can happen when something becomes popular, he's brought out this other level, calling it soul fury. And not fury in the sense of hatred or anger, but fury in the sense of the way nature has storms and the way nature has intensities. And the soul, of course, is our connection to nature, just as it's our connection to the divine. And so we're under the banner on this evening of soul fury, the furious need of the soul to be fully alive inside each person who is born.
So I want to start talking a little bit about the state that we find ourselves in now. You've alluded to it a couple of times, Michael, in you know, that need to maybe stand aside for a moment and to bring yourself into the fullness of our reality now. And our reality is a little horrifying on so many levels. We look around, we have never-ending war. We have cops out of control killing people everywhere you look. We have serious amounts of poverty, serious amounts of folks experiencing houselessness and lack of basic care. We have a global situation that's just spiraling out of control with climate change, with ecological destruction, devastation, and now, you know, plagues and epidemics, you know, just to throw that in. And I'm watching people this week. People have been very edgy, a little edgier than usual, and there's ebbs and flows to everything, you know. But it's also that fall time of year where we have this sort of deep ancestral memory of needing to scurry around and to get everything in order because we know the dark times are coming. We know the cold is coming. So we're a little... I'm watching people react out of fear base. I'm watching people react in anxiety. Right. And I'm wondering how we keep from numbing out. How do we keep engaged as we are watching things that are truly overwhelming unfold around us?
Yeah. Well, thank you for cataloging the weight of the world. And,
you know,
in 3 minutes, yeah, folks.
But there's no getting away from it. And because of the internet and things like that, it's everywhere. In other words, what's that old saying? It's the same to live in a tragic time as to live in a tragic place. So there's tragedies all over the place, but we're in a tragic time. So the story of those tragedies is constantly being broadcast. And so everyone is feeling the weight of the world in a greater way. But most of the mystic traditions, and every culture has had its mystic traditions, are about finding the light inside the darkness, not escaping the darkness, not denying the darkness, but finding the hidden light inside us. That's one of the descriptions of the soul. The soul is the light found hidden in darkness. And in a way you could say, excuse me, that soul is the missing ingredient, that whether it's a matter of the fear of Ebola or the terror produced by ISIS or whatever it is that's going to be terrifying everyone in the moment, the soul would suggest, would argue, would cry that there are deeper connections that can bring people together when everything seems to be driving everyone apart, which is what part of what fear does, but also that there are deep roots And in the realm of the soul, which is the realm of poetry and story, they say for every illness in the world, there is a cure. For every sickness, there is an antidote. So I can't prove that, but there's a suggestion there that this world that can have such terrible, you know, punishments and threats also is the world of healing, and it's the world of medicine. So for me, as the world gets darker, the medicine that I want is more of this ecstatic. And the thing about the ecstatic, it is not a departure from the world, it's a deepening of the world, which is also the essence of community. So it's the community of the spirit in the midst of the dark, looking for the community of the soul in the midst of all the illness and all the wreckage.
Indeed. As usual, when we talk to you, we always have a moment of silence, which makes radio people crazy. But sometimes you just want to let things sink in a little bit. Well, or as Rumi was saying in that song, if you wake up sad and lonely, don't go back to sleep. Or Louis Buñuel said, just walk out the door, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great phrase, don't go back to sleep, because sleep is partly the succumbing to the threat, succumbing to the fear. Not that it isn't a fearful time, it's just that it's not only a fearful time. Something in the world keeps producing flowers. Something in the world keeps producing love. Something in the world keeps producing the longing to be together in meaningful ways. And if we lose that, then we have really been caught in the plague of ignorance and denial or loss or rejection.
Right, that in fact life is still very, very good. And it is important to remember that those connections make it rich and meaningful in such depth and beauty, even as tragedy unfolds around us.
Well, I remember years and years ago, before Ram Dass had his stroke, seeing him talk, and he was working with AIDS patients, and he said, the challenge was, how do you fall in love with someone who's dying? And you know, there's gloom and doom about the earth, but there's still love.
Well, yeah, and actually everyone we love is dying.
Yeah.
And that includes us.
Yeah, that's right.
We're on the road of life and death, and it only leads to one place. And so one of the great tricks in the world is to realize, even in the midst of pain, I have the gift of life right now. And living it as fully as possible is still the most honest and proper response to the trouble in the world. And I love this idea of medicine, that there's medicine, and that, you know, it's a Native American idea that everybody's born with medicine in their soul. And so there's a way in which we each are carrying a medicine, and if more people could bring the medicine forward in a sense, then there might be more healing, even with these great, huge things that are happening. And so maybe this idea of staying awake involves finding the medicine inside oneself, finding the medicine that makes love more possible. And just to repeat, everyone we fall in love with is dying, including ourselves.
Yep, yep, yep. So I wanted to get back a little bit. I was curious. I have a friend. His name is Ralph Colson. He has interviewed you once, too, who used to attend the Robert Bly events way back in the Wayback Machine. And he said you and Coleman were kind of the Young Turks of that. Is that when you guys met? And did you spark each other kind of like Rumi and Shams? Or?
Well, I was thinking about it. We were talking the other day, and I'm not good on years, but it's over 30 years ago that I met Robert Bly, Coleman Barks, Etheridge Knight, the great African-American poet, all in the same week. And so
it's a good week.
About, yeah. And talk about waking. It was a true wake up. And so we're old friends, Coleman and I, and we have a conversation that goes off and on all the way back over 30 years. And it was always the conversation of poetry and the conversation about the muse and the conversation about how to be fully alive in the world. And now that we're both older, we were hanging out in New York a couple of years ago, and saying, you know, we should do some more things together. And so this thing that we're preparing is an attempt to maybe harvest something from this conversation of over three decades.
Well, it has the most delectable title. Yeah. I love it. I mean, if this doesn't get you to want to come, and I have it written down, and I'll remember.
What about those details again?
Yes, let's give those deets. It's going to be it's Soul Furion, evening of ecstatic poetry for passionate friends and fearless lovers. It's going to be at the Unitarian. First Congregational Church. Thank you. I'm trying to get this up on my little.
I think it's on Broadway.
Yeah. And you can go to mosaic.org to get tickets. It's Peter told me it's selling fast, so that's really good. It sounds like a tremendous evening and something very healing for people these days. And fun. The evenings that you speak are always fun. You said something last time I saw you that just totally stayed with me, saying, which sort of goes with what we're talking about today. If everything goes your way, it's not very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that idea of in paradise, everything is just perfect and the lions lay down with the lambs and all the fruit is within, you know, arm's length and the streams are full of milk and honey. How long can you take that?
I don't know.
You know,
I wouldn't mind trying it out for a while, though.
No,
really.
But people would be bored.
That's what you say.
We need some of that. We need it on a regular basis. But then we need to also get back to the world of surprise and the world where the lambs suddenly start acting strangely and decide not to be so amenable and all that kind of thing. You know? And so,
Well, I think the world of surprise is, in fact, it's an important place to go because it's in the unexpected that we find magic, right? That we actually learn about ourselves and each other and the world.
And in Africa, they say the word magic means change. And so there's another idea inside of all this ecstatic stuff. Ecstatic meaning to step out of one's usual state and be in an altered state. That's the only place where we can truly, truly change. So change is a matter of altering oneself completely. Or as they used to say, if the soul doesn't change, there's no real change happening. And so you could also imagine not just for the individual, but the soul of the world. Remember the soul of the world? Everybody used to talk about the soul of the world, that there was an essence in the world that connected everyone. And if there isn't a change that brings us closer to the soul of the world, we'll continually wake up in this world that is broken and kind of specializing in division and separation.
Yep. We are positively revolting. We are here this morning talking with Michael Mead. If you have a question for Michael and would like to do that, you may call in at 503-231-8187. You can email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com if you don't feel like talking. And we are, as always, on Facebook. Like us there at Positively Revolting. We are even on the Twitters at Positive Revolt. So many places to do, and it's 8:23 in the morning right now. So if you've got a question for Michael, get it on in. Don't wait till 8:45. It's 503-231-8187.
Hey, questions, comments, impressions. I mean, this is really conversational stuff, and so as opposed to I think it's important to have deeper conversations on conceptual levels because it's really how we frame the world. It's how we it's the basis, really, of our lives. And it's good to examine it every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think.
Well, a little off this topic, I was looking on your website this morning and I saw a thing about Crush the Fog. Now, you live in Vashon Island, and it sounds like there were some deaths that happened there. I have a group of friends that we just had two people killed in a car crash. Suddenly, boom. And I was saying to them, because I remember hearing you talk about this, that at some point we need to get together and do some sort of ceremony to close the door on death.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you're one of the only people that I know of that thinks about those things. So did you want to talk about Crush the Fog, or is
well,
that...
I'll say something about, yeah, I'll say something about it because, you know, while we're aware of all the great tragedy in the world, then we're also encountering individual tragedies, the loss of people that we didn't expect to lose, or loss of young people in particular. So that's part of what happened in this little island community of 10,000 people. There were 15 tragic deaths in less than 2 years, which really started
to
have ramifications throughout the whole community. And of the 15, 10 of them were between 14 years old and 27 years old. So it was as if something was striking at the heart of the community in terms of the youth being the, you know, the heart at times. And so... So eventually we just figured out a way to get together, and we had, we just turned this outdoor area into a series of ceremonial or ritual spots where a person could move some of their energy, release some of the pain and the fears and the anguish and the grief, but do it as a collective of people of all different ages and coming from all different points of view. And just to give it a sense of it, we created a pool in the ground. It was small, but it represented the deep water and the water of the soul. And when you arrived at it, there was music playing softly, and then someone would give you a stone. And you, if you held a stone, and then you thought about some conflict you had, because whether it's inside or outside, and because all communities on the way to communing develop conflicts. And in a small community, I've noticed that those conflicts can be held for decades and decades because there's no mechanism for releasing them. So the idea was you held the stone and considered some conflict that you have, and then you dropped it into the water. And for that night, all the conflicts were in the water. Water is the element of reconciliation. And so the idea was on the way in here, drop your conflict. Because we're looking for healing, not to intensify the conflicts. And then there was a fire, a beautiful fire where you could, which was set and prayed over by young people who had lost friends to suicide. They were the ones that, you know, we helped them set that fire in the right way. And at that fire, you could burn away anything that was an obstacle to healing or an obstacle to growing. And then from there, you could pass through. There happened to be some trees there. And inside, and we call it trees of forgiveness, because one of the things I've noticed from working with all kinds of people, but particularly with battle veterans, is the absolute need for forgiveness. And so as you pass through the trees, where they were like little singing bowls that were making these beautiful sounds, but there was also people speaking. And as you passed through, it seemed like the trees were speaking, and they were saying, the trees forgive you, the earth forgives you, your family forgives you. One woman was telling me that she went through everything, and she was thinking, this is really fine. And then she heard the words, your family forgives you, and she fell down on her knees, realizing something about her whole history of her family and the lack of forgiveness. Anyway, people got all through to there, and then we all wound up standing in front of this shrine altar that was built of wood. And the idea was that you would light a candle for beginning with those 15 people who had died, whose names had to be said, who were the shared kind of loss of the community. But then the old idea is that when one person dies, it's a funeral for everyone who has died. And so then people started calling in the names of friends and relatives who have died, particularly recently, but others as well. And then each time you had a name, you lit a candle and put it on the this big shrine. By now it's very dark, and what's happening is the flame, which represents the name of the person who has died, which represents a prayer for them in a way, all those flames are now on this shrine, which is glowing and flickering and illuminated with the light of care and the light of pain and the light of the prayers that people had said. And that's the light inside the darkness. So everything went dark. And yet he was this burning light that represented our connection to the unseen world, our connection to each other, and our connection and love for those we have lost. And so that was the shape of what we did. The idea was to bring in everyone of the different ages and the different perspectives and different religious and political beliefs. But for one night, let's not have conflict. For one night, let's just feel the compassion for ourselves and let's touch forgiveness or be touched by it if we can. And the idea was to kind of close the door on tragedy and then open these doors to a deeper, more soulful community connection.
That's
beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one thing we are so lacking for the most part. It's an intentional outpouring of grief and somehow putting some boundaries on that. Because I've had, like, the last few years, both my parents died, and I've just there's been some more death in my life than is normal for me, and grief can just, you know, sneak up on you. And somehow I really like that idea of having a very intentional outpouring and then, you know, close. This is where the living are and this is where the dead are. Because grief can sort of blur those lines.
Yeah. And in this, you know, from my perspective, in this culture, and you see it in this small community really clearly, actually, people have forgotten how to do funeral in a way. And there's a tendency to have solemnness that leave everybody in some kind of lost place, right, where there hasn't been enough genuine expression and there hasn't been any kind of turn. The idea of a funeral is to separate the living from the dead, to have pay one's respects to the dead, and to gather oneself back as part of the living. And so that's why a lot of cultures, after the funeral, there's a big party. Mm-hmm. Because the living have to go back to life. It's not that you forget those who have died, but you have to make a clear consideration that they're in another world, and we have to go back to the world that we're still living in. And unfortunately, because I think the funerals aren't thorough enough, and the intention of the funeral is lost or confused, many people are carrying corpses.
Yeah.
Carrying the dead. I mean, we actually found within this thing we were working on that some of the young people were wearing the clothes of those who had their young friends who had died.
Right.
And you can understand that connection. At the same time, there's a kind of a misunderstanding there where you're wrapping yourself in death or wrapping yourself in the grief. And so the older idea would be to express it all fully, and grief can have anger in it and confusion and all kinds of stuff in it. Express it fully and then go fully back to life.
Right.
And so there was a point when all these lights are burning on the shrine, like over 1,000 lights burning, then everybody sings. You know, we learned a song and everybody sings and sings and sings and sings until all the feeling is gathered. And then we come to the end. And we just stood in silence. And somehow the depth of that silence was an expression that said, all right, we have created a sense, a place of deep feeling, and we have created a kind of a conclusion. And then we went inside, and there was food, and there was live music, and there was conversation, right, and eventually dancing. And that was our way of trying to interrupt the procession of tragedy.
Well, the thing that really strikes me as you're talking about the ritual and about the importance of being conscious with, you know, these very deep, deep feelings that you know, we need to be in touch with to be healthy, to be fully alive, to be fully engaged. And yet, it's the normative in our society to kind of, well, cut ourselves off right about there at the head. We can think about these things, but to actually feel them with each other is scary. It makes us vulnerable. It's not seemly. Many of us come from Euro-American backgrounds that, I was raised Brit. You know, worse things happen at sea, mustn't grumble, stiff upper lip, go on. you don't express a lot of emotion, and especially in community. I mean, you know, those people are your neighbor. You're going to see them at the shop next day. You know, you don't want to, you know, be out of control and actually weepy in front of somebody.
It's a small island.
So, again, just getting into it and actually allowing ourselves to understand the importance, the huge importance of sharing deep emotion with each other. When you talk about the typical sort of American funeral, you know, you don't have those kinds of real deep, it's not okay. You can cry politely and there's a box of tissue. That's kind of expected. But I'm, you know, in comparison to the ritual that you're talking about, the typical American funeral is really anemic.
Yeah, it's kind of a captured and reduced thing. I've had the good fortune of being involved in some African funerals, and it's such an education in a way, because there's heavy grieving. I mean, especially the family, anyone close to the person who has died, and they do it with the, you know, the deceased present, the body of the deceased is present, you know, so that there's a moment where you realize you're in between now with that one you loved. They're not quite gone, because there I can see the body, and yet their life has gone out of them, and so they dwell in that, and they get all this expression out. But at the same time, all new dances are invented on the funeral ground. And so people come out, and because there's drums playing, there's music playing on the funeral ground, and people start to dance, and someone will invent a new dance, and other people will start to learn it on the spot. And while the grieving is also going on, as if to say we're in that place where life and death interact, and then the elders sit, they have a place to sit, and they tend to tell jokes, gallows humor, that, you know, that kind of thing. They joke about death as if to say we have to keep humor in this, or we'll lose our humanity in the face of loss and in the face of death. And so they have everything present all on the same ground. That was a real education for me, to realize that there's something about acknowledging death is leads to an increase of life, or vice versa. Remember Octavio Paz, the Mexican poet, said, a culture that begins by denying death will end by denying life. And so when we don't do death properly, we're denying ourselves a chance at life. And young people are completely confused by the way the typical funeral and handling of sorrow and death happens in modern culture. You can watch them just like confused.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be solemn at this moment, simply solemn.
Well, I don't know about your Irish heritage, but mine, they had some wild wakes. And there was massive gallows humor.
Yes. Exactly. They had the same instinct. Everybody used to have it. And then wake is connected to the word awake. You do a wake properly and everybody wakes up. Mm-hmm. And so death used to be called the teacher. Death used to be called that which wakes us up to realize we are alive. Even though we're in the midst of loss, we are alive. So I have a little poem.
Good.
It's called The Tent. Outside, the freezing winter night. Yet, this other night inside grows warm with secret kindling. So let the landscape be covered with a cold, thorny crust. We have a soft garden hidden in here. Yes, the continents can be blasted apart, all the cities and towns, and everything can become a scorched, blackened ball. The news we hear is more and more full of grief for the future. But the real news is in each of us, and inside, there's no news at all.
Thank you.
Ooh.
So inside isn't the news. Inside is that which is old.
Right.
Not new. That which is old and enduring. That, you know, because life endures. Life has always been confronted with confusion, disaster, and death. And life endures. And eventually, to be, you know, an awake person means to keep finding that enduring ever-awakening part of oneself, not by denying death and sorrow and loss and confusion, but in right in the midst of it. And that's the mystic tradition.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, what all the mystic poets about. And that's been their job. You know, all that mystic poetry from Rumi, from Hafez, from even from the Western tradition, where you find it also in Rilke and many others, was all found in the midst of loss and pain and sorrow. They didn't write those poems because they were at the height of accomplishment in the world.
Right.
You know, the Sufis are part of the lost caravan. They're part of the caravan that's wandering on the dark roads. And it's from there comes this enduring longing and beauty and love of life.
I want to remind people you're listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. We are fortunate enough to have as our guest once again Michael Mead, mythologist, storyteller,
raconteur,
and amazing fella, really, who will be coming to town a week from Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Soul Fury is the name of the evening.
First Congregational Church is the place it's going to happen. That's on 1137 Southwest Broadway. I think it's starting at 7:30, but go to mosaicvoices.org and you can get tickets for that event.
And just also to let you know, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, join Angie and Marvin on Veterans Voice as they open the phone lines and discuss war in the world. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, which features a speech given in Berkeley by Naomi Klein for her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. At 11 o'clock, hear Startup City, a five-week series looking at the new tech industry in the Portland area. At 11:10, on Radio Zine, host Per Fogring speaks with Philip Comella. He's a practicing attorney, radio show host, and author of The Collapse of Materialism, which is about human consciousness, the mind, and matter. And, of course, we want to thank KBOO members for your generous support during our membership drive. Thank you ever so much for helping us actually wrap up our membership drive early, first time in years. You are marvelous. And with that, we are Positively Revolting here with Michael Mead. And we invite your calls at 503-231-8187. You can also find us on Facebook, Positively Revolting. You can follow us on the Twitterverse, Positive Revolt. And there's the email, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. And Lynn, over to you.
Wasn't
that good? That was pretty good. Yeah, I practiced.
Sylvia, you called and accidentally got hung up on. Please feel free to call back. We're a community. Oh, well, Sylvia, you are here. Hello? Sylvia? Or not.
Okay, so Sylvia, please come back to us and we would love to talk to you.
Okay, so Michael, let's talk a little bit more about the event in case some folks are just tuning in about the Soul Fury that you and Coleman Barks and Pia are going to be doing a week from Saturday.
So we're thinking of it as a conversation bringing forth this deep voice of Rumi, who was in conversation with Shams, and the mystery of that and how it produced poetry that's been translated into almost every language, and that Coleman is, you know, premier translator of into English. But also, you know, the other voices in the conversation that help us carry ourselves through life, which, you know, for me is also Hafez, another mystical poet, but William Stafford, I'm sure, will appear because he always appears when we're in Oregon. And so we'll be going and pulling the poems from those enduring voices. And then Pia brings songs and music from so many different cultures, which is going to be woven into it as well. So sometimes it'll be a conversation between Coleman and myself, and then between Coleman and Pia and the music, and then we all join in, and then the audience joins in, and it's just this searching for ways to touch the divine. Maybe that's another way to say it. And it's, of course, it's not religious in that sense. It's just the idea. One of the jobs of the mystics in every culture has always been to get people to realize that everybody's carrying a spark of the divine. And the reason we can imagine something beyond ourselves is because something hidden in ourselves is beyond ourselves. And so it's a night to find that spark. And that spark is what keeps producing love and beauty. And so we're going to be trying to find that spark in many ways. And
Thank you. That no religion owns the divine.
Here's what Rumi says. Not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu or Buddhist, not Sufi or Zen, not any religion or cultural system. I am not from the East or the West, not out of the ocean or up from the ground, not simply natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all. I do not exist, am not an entity in this world or in the next one, did not descend from Adam and Eve or any origin story. My place is placeless, a priceless, neither body or soul. I belong only to the beloved and have seen the two worlds as one and heard the one call to know. First, last, outer, inner, only that breath, that breathing continuing inside each human being. So that's how they talk, you know.
Wow.
Rumi was rapping, you know.
He
was a little hip hop there.
He was totally.
So it has rhythm and it has song in it and it has both intensity in it but also humor in it.
Yeah.
And we're trying to find the trace of the traceless. We're trying to, for one evening at least, reveal the unseen, you know, to our own surprised selves. And we'll be, you know, pulling poems in the moment. We'll be finding things to see and say that are born from the garden of music and the garden of inspiration, looking for those altered states that are actually... You know, the human soul is always in an altered state. And it's, you know, it's there's part of us that's always in a state other than Oregon, in a state other than Washington, in a state other than the condition of the world. That's what we're looking for, is that altered state that is the place where the soul dwells.
Excellent. You're going to bring down the roof like you have before. Sylvia has been waiting.
Let's try Sylvia again.
Sylvia.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Good morning. Gosh, this was a godsend for this program, I tell you. I'm going to condense everything. I think just listening right now answered some of my questions, but I guess I'm just really in the middle of some really horrific stuff. I've been in contact with all the other worlds and the ecstasy and the beauty and the spirits, etc., etc., but... in just this microcosm of where I live, and I have to work alone. I'm a hermit. That's part of my job, and I'm allergic to the electronics. So, I keep watching the relentless destruction of Mother Earth. I have this connection with Mother Earth, and she's been mutilated, poisoned, etc., etc., and it goes on endlessly, and I see it every day. And what's happening now is that the rock people that I make, it's been going on for a while, you know, they're spirit beings, and they're pouring out all these warnings, and I've heard, you know, warnings for years, but this is just a real escalation. And the water, it's being attacked right and left, like people like the organization Metro. They think they're restoring the ecosystem. That's an abstraction. It has nothing to do with a living being. And with machines and money, it's gotten to the point, I went in the water, it's been going on for a while, and the water has soul sickness. I've never encountered that before. I've encountered all these other things. But now it's this really, really bad soul sick. I know I have to embrace all of that, and I do. You know, the total surrender. But all the spirit beings have gone away, all the little earth goddesses that took care of all these places for hundreds and hundreds of years, the Native Americans, you know, it's all the ancestors that come to me. They're all gone. It's all, and it's relentless. Is there an end to that?
Wow. Well, I don't know about, you know, there is an end to that, or there's many endings to that. But yeah, we're living in the dark times. And according to the old traditions, something in us decided to come to life at this time. There is something in the soul of a person that can withstand all this loss. In a sense, we're in a big funeral. There's loss of species that are counted every day. There's loss of languages, you know, especially through the internet and the reduction of languages required, in a sense, for commerce mostly. But anyway, we're losing languages. We're losing species as we walk around. And the soul knows this. That's why it feels so heavy. And yet, the world is a bigger place than anything anyone can describe. And one of the things about the news, and the news is everywhere, is the news never mentions the other world. They can't imagine the other world. Mm-hmm. And so it's up to the individuals to find that other world, you know, of the soul. And I really sympathize with everything you're saying, but I'm going to keep going back to the poets because, you know, that's the path we're on. So here's Rumi again. It's called Presences. Listen to the presences inside. You could also say, listen to the presences inside the flowers. Listen to the presences inside the roots of the trees that are still reaching for the sun, regardless of how much it rains. Let them take you where they will and follow each private hint unflinchingly. And don't ever leave the premises until you have found something divine. Where it all ends, the end of all the march of grief and the procession of loss, ends when people touch the divine again. It's the missing thing. The soul is the missing ingredient that keeps us from finding the genuine community. And then the missing sense that we are close to the divine all the time. I remember the early on listening to Coleman's translations of Rumi and hearing him say that the world inside is bigger than the world outside. That was something I needed to hear, that there's something inside us that is bigger than everything that is outside us. And maybe the answer or the end to the procession of loss only occurs when we find ourselves back in the wonder of realizing that the gift of life has the spark of the divine in it. And we turn, imagine America so dedicated to everything outside. Imagine what would happen if it turned back inside. I'm just arguing from the mystic road.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from you.
Take care, Sylvia.
Let's try and squeeze Deanna in here, if we could.
Good morning.
Good morning, Deanna.
It's been wonderful, and how happy for me that it comes right on the heels of having attended Milagro Theater last night, their presentation of O Romeo.
Yes.
Which was an incredible celebration of many of the things that Michael is talking about. Not all of them, of course, but I was lifted so incredibly. It's the first time I've ever felt this experience of reunion, which was presented so beautifully in this play, reunion of life and death, interweaving of life and death. And what I took away from this was the amazing creative power that arises within us. And this creative power seemed to have its source in a combination, interweaving of playfulness and grief and memory and celebration and humor. And, well, that's really all I want to contribute, except to encourage everyone both to go to Michael's. I've already bought my ticket. And also to go to Teatro Milagro for an experience that you will really celebrate.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, think we can fit one more person in?
I think we can.
All right. Frances.
Hi.
Hi.
I've enjoyed your conversation this morning, and having been raised an Irish Catholic, I've been to a lot of wakes. But I wanted to share something. I was married about 44 years ago, actually, There's a lot of magic in the air, by the way, this autumn. I'll feel it. But I was married to a man. He's African-American and White Mountain Apache. And for the majority of those 44 years, he has been in prison. We speak of our love being... Leon Russell wrote a song called... I can't remember the name of it, but there are words like, I love you in a place where there is no time or space. And that, to me, is the divine. And there have been moments in our lives where we have been reunited and as if we have never been apart. And recently he was released from prison, and I had the wonderful experience of just walking through our town together as we did when we were very young. And we were sitting in Over in Larry Hill Park the other day and realized something blessed is around us and with us. He has experienced a lot in our criminal justice system. He has maintained a calmness and a spirit that is awesome to me. I have also gone with him to places I had not been before in our city. I was a guest with him where he was going to eat downtown at one of the, it was Union Gospel Mission. And among a lot of the people, the street people that I met, there is this awareness of that spirit that is kind of, I believe, what has maintained them throughout their, what may be perceived to be very difficult living situations right now. And I would like to say to the baby who just called, expressing a lot of desperation, that I have never in my life, even though all of these things are happening, our babies are being killed by police, been so aware of that spirit that is still there. It's very strong, and I feel as though it's just trying to find a way to present itself to us where we don't have to continue doing these things the way we're doing them, embalming babies in Iraq and those sorts of things. We don't have to do that.
Right.
It could happen
right.
in an instant that could happen.
And Francis, that's about exactly.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you really for sharing. We're just about out of time, though. But thank you so much.
With that, we thank Michael.
Mm-hmm.
For joining us once again here on Positively Revolting. Michael, one more time, the details of your appearance next week.
I can do it.
Okay. Okay. I was going to give Michael a chance, but
No.
Well, it's next Saturday night.
Soul Fury, an evening of ecstatic poetry for passionate friends and fearless lovers. I just got to say that again because I love it. It's going to be at the First Congregational Church, 1137 Southwest Broadway. You can get tickets at mosaicvoices.org. It's at 7:30. Be there or be square.
And we call that Saturday the 25th.
Saturday, October 25th. Thank you so much, Michael, and look forward to next Saturday's event.
Well, thank you both for being positively revolting and beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Our job. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We'll see you soon. And to all listeners everywhere.
And all the ships at sea, as Teresa Mitchell would say.
I can't copy, my sweetie.
I can.
You know, yeah, you can. We'll see you next week.
Indeed.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the place where everything is music. Everything is music. Oh, everything is music. Yeah, we've come to the place where everything is music. Everything is music. Let it play, let it play. Tell me, why do you stay in jail when the door is wide? Stay in jail when the door is wide open.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Veterans Voice. Today on the show, Angie and Marvin are going to open up the phone lines and discuss war in the world. So get ready to call in with your ideas about that. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we're going to hear Flashpoints, which features a speech given in Berkeley by Naomi Klein, talking about her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. At 11 o'clock, hear Startup City. It's a five-week series looking at the new tech industry in the Portland area. And at 11:10 on the Radio Zine, host Per Fogering speaks with Philip Comella, practicing attorney, radio show host, and author of The Collapse of Materialism, about human consciousness, the mind, and matter. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, which helped us